Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Game Audio Podcast, episode 36.
Ah, 36.
Wow.
We've been at this a while.
Yeah. I'm Anton, joining here by
Damien. It's me.
Great. We also got some guests today. Why don't you introduce them, Damien?
Wow. Well, super excited to have these fine fellows on the podcast today. First, we got...
And me.
Kenny Young chiming in from way over on the other side of the pond from
Hi.
Where I'm at.
I'm near Anton.
That's true. Welcome, Kenny. And Rob, you're closer to Anton as well. Rob Bridget.
I am, yeah. I'm on the East Coast. I think I'm further away from you than anybody, you know, mentally and physically. And, yeah.
I think I'm on the far left, and you're just a little closer to
the
center.
You're on the far left. I'm on the sort of in the
center. Let's not bring politics into this. That's...
Yeah. Well, I'm center. I'm definitely center.
Well, yeah. Anyway, it's great to have you guys. Yeah. Thanks for coming out today.
Yeah,
it's so good to be back on the show, Damien. It really is, man. It's been a while.
Thanks.
I think, Rob, you were on the show back in, what was it, 2010?
Oh,
I think it was one about mixing, right?
Yeah.
Officially 2010.
Yeah.
That was a long time ago, eh?
3 years.
It was, but he was on all those GDC.
Oh, yeah. It's only been a podcast.
The specials. Yeah.
We only had like two episodes in between the last GDC episode anyway, so.
That's true.
I have to say, I'm really impressed that you guys have managed to keep it going so long. Not because it should have died, but just because it's really hard. I know how hard it is to keep a podcast going, and it's still going, and it's still good.
Yeah, thanks.
Until this episode.
This will be the last episode, Kenny. So.
Well, in that case, if it's anything like South Park, I'm definitely going to die.
Anything goes.
In this
episode. Because you've got the gas explosion.
I'm getting a new gas main being installed, but it's okay. We're recording in high quality at this end, so... You know,
yeah, pitch it down.
If I do die, you've got to use it in each game you work on forever.
Yeah, the Wilhelm gas explosion.
Nice.
Yeah, like how this is working out.
Just to honor your memory, man, we'll do it.
Rob was there when we were gathering every morning, way too early at side class. I don't recall Kenny ever joining us in the early mornings.
I think I maybe went to one of those once, and then I was like, I'm never doing this again.
I've never seen Kenny in sight glass.
Well,
that's weird.
I think we can. It's pretty safe to say now that we can. We're gonna repeat the experience from last year, this GDC. So you get another chance.
Cool. All right. I'll promise. I'm there.
So the podcast is still alive because of people like you continue to talk about some really interesting things and create some really interesting game audio out there. I mean, some really amazing stuff off of the shelf from both of you this year. Kenny, obviously, with the Tearaway business, and Rob will kind of circle around to your new game audio culture book and the writing that you've been doing lately. But, you know, the Game Audio Podcast is really about trying to extend the things that you guys are all doing and that we're all thinking and talking about. And so it's, again, thanks for being who you are and doing what you do, because that's why we're here.
Yeah, so for this episode, we don't really have a theme per se, but you guys have been writing and creating so much stuff over the last while since we last talked that I think from what you guys have been doing, we found a lot of common ground in that. So I think we'll just dive into it and the conversation will happen automatically.
Automatic conversation.
Yeah. there's a good generative audio idea.
Automatic conversation for the people.
Yeah.
System.
Engine. What's the acronym for that? That's great. What is it again? Automatic conversation for the people. No, it doesn't work. No, we can't call it that.
No, it doesn't have some kind
of... It's more like an organization. Isn't it?
You got something in your throat, I think.
It's a union.
Yeah. Oh, no. No one expects the Actpe Inquisition.
No.
It sounds like a very good single malt, though, so...
Ooh.
Bound to be.
Japanese single malt.
High percentage.
What about a Dutch single malt, though? The first one actually is already
now. Do they do that?
Yeah. I've actually tasted one the other day. It's really nice.
Oh yeah, no, you sent me a link to one, didn't you?
Yeah, the Frisian one. Yeah, with the horse on the top of the thing.
Oh,
yeah.
That looks like good stuff.
Yeah,
you've got a horse on the bottle.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think sight glass mornings could be even better with a little Dutch whiskey. Yeah. Bring it on.
Oh, hip now flask. We're dangerous.
A hip flask with a horse on it.
Yeah.
Now we're talking. Now we're talking. So,
let's see. Before we dive right into meaty, gritty stuff, let's do some little things, I think. First of all, I want to congratulate you, Damien. I don't think we talked about it in the last podcast. You have finally joined the ranks of the in-house sound designer. You've landed.
I heard they bricked up your door so you couldn't leave.
A little bit like that. But no, yeah, I took a job at PopCap. So, yeah.
Well, not just any job. Let's hear the official title, because I think it's a first.
This is a first in the games industry,
I think. Maybe you guys can correct me if I'm wrong.
Technical audio lead.
Ooh.
Wow.
I remember a while back, Damien, Microsoft were looking for a technical audio director. Do you remember that?
I do. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm sure that's what you'll be doing, essentially, that.
Something like that.
I just can't picture what you'll be doing.
Well, it's a fascinating adventure. That's kind of part of the fun, right? Is getting to make it up as I go along.
Make up the job titles, make it up.
Yeah, but Anton and I were talking, you know, what he does is very similar in that, you know, if you think about it, it's basically just trying to facilitate the technical direction of sound for the game, right? And trying to make that as smooth a process for the team as possible.
Are you an audio programmer? Would you call yourself an audio programmer in any sense?
Right. No.
No.
No. No. No. No. No.
I always get the technical. I always. The technical is very programmatic.
And the way I see it, if it's similar to what I don't have that title at all. Obviously, I'm just sound designer. But the part of the position of where I am in the company is more of a liaison between the code and the sound team. Just because you get to a certain scale of asset making, that it's easier if one person does the more complicated conversations with code, because you get so complicated in the engine and its features that knowing all the features that are already there for a coder is difficult, because you can get information from so many different angles.
But presumably with both of you, really important side of getting technical stuff right is that you also obviously need to use the stuff. You need to be an implementer.
Yeah.
You need to be a sound designer. You can't just be like this segregated tech person who doesn't have any clue about sound design.
Exactly.
Otherwise, you're making tools and things for like some academic exercise.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the things I've been trying to do is to... A lot of people try to say, the creative part and the technical part of sound design. I try to say there's an artistic part and a more technical part. Because the technical part of sound design is just as creative as the artistic part, but it is more about thinking in systems or in thinking about how it interacts with the game, and less about how do I create the best sounding WAV files. If you're going to make it completely black and white, right? So, what was I going with that? I don't know.
Again, it's a niche that I have slipped into easily as a freelancer over the last 7 years. It's always been bridging this gap between content creators and the game engine, and you know, to varying degrees, but essentially it was a pretty rich vein of experience for me that I was really interested in trying to facilitate making it easier for people, right? Because I feel like their game audio has had a hard time getting a semblance or a standard of how to do things. It's only been in the last console generation where I feel like we have gotten a grip on some kind of emerging standard of how we do things. And that's just in maybe a middleware or a proprietary tool, you know, which has been allowed to evolve. But now the big gap is between that standard and a game engine. And you have all the various systems that encompass a game engine, and how you tie sound to those has become the new challenge, I think, for me anyway. So that's the part that I'm most excited about having the opportunity at PopCap to do, is again just help to try and bridge that gap for creative sound designers and people who are trying to get sound in the game, and developers who are trying to get sound for their games. So, you know, bridging that gap. And it brings me to an interesting quote from your article, Kenny, on Tearaway, that I was really kind of touched by, which was, if I can just quote it quickly so we can talk about it a bit.
Go for it.
Interactive audio tool sets increasingly deliver on the promise of empowering the autonomous audio designer. But it's a double-edged sword. On one hand, it opens the floodgates for experimentation and investigations without the bottleneck of other people getting in the way. But on the other hand, it further enables and permits the entrenched make do and mend attitude adopted by or ingrained into many audio folk. Again, I thought that that was you made a really good point there, in that, you know, we have achieved a sort of autonomy within our pipeline.
Yeah, it's been the dream for a long time. Like, I remember not that long ago, that was the conversations we were having, was, you know, one day we're going to have these tools and they're going to let us do whatever we want. And but the cool thing is, we're kind of in that place now. You know, it's not, you know, limitless possibilities, but it is a place where, particularly I think with a lot of people are settled on, you know, a really small number of middleware tools. So there is this kind of standardization across the industry now, which in many respects is a really positive step forward. That's also a double-edged sword. That's like, everyone's got the same tech, which is cool for freelancers. Like, I mean, I'm sure that must have been a big part of your kind of previous career, if I can call it that, as a freelance sort of technical sound design specialist, where they're like, let's get that guy.
It's easy. We'll drop him in. He already knows the tool, right? He can just hit the ground running.
Yeah, that's good for a freelancer, because that means you can get people in and they've worked on various projects and they already know the tool set. That's fantastic. As someone who's hiring in freelancers, that's great. But it also means you have that thing where everyone's got the same tools and you have that question mark hanging over you, is what impact does that have on the technical capabilities of everyone's games? And, you know, even though games are an entertainment medium, they are fundamentally, a big part of them is still technology. And if we've all got the same technology, what does that mean for our creative endeavors, you know?
Yeah.
Are we all going to make the same game?
I understand where you're going with that, right? But I guess I would throw it back and say, you know, did all music sound the same when we had tape machines? Does it all sound the same today now that everyone's got a DAW? And I think that, you know, everyone's going to find their own creative use for it. And, you know, Tearaway doesn't sound anything like Forza. You both used FMod. You know,
great. That was a great juxtaposition.
But though, wouldn't you say, just if you take that analogy, right? Wouldn't you say that musicians that made their own instruments, of which there are plenty, were much more on, well, some of them at least, were much more on the edge of what was possible with music? If you would only use instruments in the standard tuning, right? Then you wouldn't have Sonic Youth. I'm not saying that you cannot go very far with an off-the-shelf middleware and you can't customize it. But you get to a certain point in that area, and I know we go back and forth on this subject for 5 years now.
I guess the way Miles Davis blows that horn, man, I don't know. It's like,
sure,
he did a thing, like I said, and it was not like any other thing.
No, but of course. But on the other hand, there's also great music out there made with completely homemade instruments. There's a place for both. And I think for me, at least, where we are now, the integration with the rest of the toolset being almost in the same toolset as a game coder or a game designer is very powerful. And
I mean, in that trick you were doing with the Lemur, where you were like dialing in things in the Killzone engine.
And we implemented OSC in our toolset. So Rob in, was it? Yeah, it was in 2007 GDC that you gave a talk about
Yeah. The Mackie control.
Yeah, Scarface, right? Yeah. Ever since then, I was like, yeah, why doesn't everybody have that? It took me a couple of years, but then we got OSC implemented in the tool set that we have. So anything on the tool, you can see in anything with OSC. So we took the Lemur app for iPad and implemented an interface for that in our tool set. So you can mix and save files, whatever. So,
yeah, one of the first things our art director said to me when he saw the Mackie control mix and stuff was like, well, I need this so I can just sit there at the end and just tweak all the colors, just like just sort of sit there and I can just tweak all this stuff.
Yeah.
I would say like, well, yeah, you can do that. That's exactly what we're doing.
Yeah.
It's just numbers. You're just moving numbers around on faders.
Yeah.
But the other interesting thing is like that is almost some kind of antidote to what I started out saying is, you know, like if everyone's using the same thing, then there is this kind of homogeneity which has positive and negatives. But if you have some kind of flexibility to kind of wire into that, then all of a sudden, I mean, fundamentally, OSC is just a very simple kind of, you know, communication protocol. But it allows you to build your own user interface and then send signals to this thing. And that's a big part of what we actually do when we're making games is, you know, you're creating this user. Everything's a UI, right, in that regard. So you're creating this stuff and stuff happens on the screen and you're letting people interact. And then we play sounds, we play music. That's games, people. But, you know, fundamentally, if you've got a tool set that allows you to have a little microcosm of that and allow you to, like you were saying, you know, set up a little color wheel so you could dial up in post to the what's-its that arty people do. What's it called? Color correction.
The flesh tones.
Yeah, flesh tones and such like.
I don't know.
Orange and teal. Everything orange and teal.
Stop making my sound orange. Damn it.
Well, that's the thing, though. If you give someone that sort of flexibility and freedom where they can instantly see changes, then that opens up a massive workflow change for those people in that team, and the way they make games almost can become completely different because they suddenly have instant feedback and they're like, well, why don't we just make everything orange and teal because it looks awesome.
Yeah.
And the whole direction of the project could change based on this crazy idea that someone got just from mucking with a tool that they didn't have before. I love that. I love that application of technology.
And I feel like an audio analogy to the mix is appropriate here, where, you know, you have 10 people in the mix room, everyone's hand on a fader, and you're pushing and pulling things.
That's how it is.
You know, and that's where great ideas happen sometimes, or where the magic happens. And so, yeah, moving towards that real time is definitely changes the paradigm, right? Because
I love now, because with Wise and FMod Studio and even FMod Designer to some extent, you can have that real time. You know, you can have someone sit down at your desk, a designer or whoever, and just sit down and try things out real quick in real time as the game's running, rather than, you know, having a meeting with a bunch of people, writing down notes, going away, trying it out, and forgetting what the impetus of that suggestion was, you know, like everything. Yeah. I think tools are making things a lot easier to just sit down and collaborate, which is something that really, really interests me.
But the other massive thing which has become easier is also on the sort of the game audio education side of things, the fact that, you know, you could always download Wise or FMod and check out the thing. But now, you know, with Wise, you've got Limbo. You've got a whole game with a project there to check out. And that is, it's like a no-brainer, right? Mm. But that's new.
Yeah.
And there's a whole load of people who are just learning about game audio, you know, who are going to come into the industry with a much better understanding of how things work than when I was a lad. And that's great. I think that's also really positive when you consider that the number of in-house jobs, I'm sure, as a percentage, are less than they used to be. I'm sure there's much more people doing freelance work and contract work, particularly with, you know, the huge number of smaller projects in development these days.
Mm.
And so when I was starting out, the chicken and egg situation was just you just had to get a job in the industry. And that was really the only way to kind of learn, if you like, was to get that in-house job. And that wasn't like 100% the case, but that was like, for a lot of people, that was basically their in to the industry. And then obviously once you've got some experience, you can look at being freelance, et cetera, et cetera. But now I would imagine most people's route into the industry actually comes through freelance work, just because that's where most of the work is. And so having that accessibility to the tools for people is of massive benefit to them and to the industry.
If you look at the film industry, right, you can't download Pro Tools for free. You can't download Nuendo for free and just start learning that stuff.
They won't send you the master mix of the latest Disney movie and give it a try to remix it.
So that mobility from student to sort of skilled practitioner is just incredibly effortless now, I think, and sort of free flowing. Even getting into film, I think it is still like a something you have to sort of, you know, mentor with somebody and be a part of a company and do the runner thing and still get in that way, right? I don't think that's changed.
I think
because of technology, our game audio, the way in has changed a lot there.
I think even in LA, that's changing a little bit, though. I don't have a lot of evidence for that. But for example, Jamie Scott, I was an intern for him back in 2007. And at the time, he was mostly doing games, particularly for Epic Games, Gears of War, that kind of stuff. And he was doing smaller movies. So I don't know the budgets of it, but not the big budget AAA movies in LA. But he didn't come from movies. He came from being an in-house sound designer for games, then went on to LA as a freelancer, started to do smaller projects in games there, like a freelancer from his own studio, and is doing currently some movie, I don't know the title, on the Epic lot, or sorry, the Sony lot there. So that path also exists there, but I don't think to the same extent in the games industry, just because movies are also not changing so much themselves, like how movies are being made is not really changing too much
relatively. Because of the technology, right?
Yeah, because
technology
also the medium doesn't
changing,
yeah, and the market and the doesn't really change because we're buying games completely different from 5 years ago. Now we're buying completely different games than 5 years now, like
that's
and creating
thing, though,
games.
Right? Yeah, that but I think that's the thing, is like the games themselves have changed. So in a way, we're talking about games as this one big thing, but of course, if you want to work on AAA, then there are still in-house jobs and there's still a lot of contract work as well. Whereas smaller teams, which doesn't necessarily mean small games, because you can have a small team working a game which still sells millions of units. So it's like, what does AAA mean anymore?
Like, what did it mean before? Geez, I don't know.
Don't think too hard on that one. Stop looking behind the curtain. Bad things will happen.
So another interesting aspect of the article you wrote was how you approached the pre-production aspect of Tearaway.
Do you have a quote to remind me?
Damien is coming up with a quote right now. But I think the thing that stuck with me, so I won't have a quote, but maybe if I give you some lines, you'll remember.
Jog my memory.
Yes, exactly. Important question was, how do you get the paper in there without everything sounding like paper?
Oh, right, yeah. I mean, it was one of those things which was, I knew it was going to be a problem, not like the instant I thought about the project, but like, you know, it reared its head from really early on, where we were working on the prototype version of the game. You know, it wasn't even trying to look particularly pretty, but it was nonetheless still trying to look a bit papery, because that art direction was there from the get-go. But even though it looked papery, it was just like the world looked a bit papery. There was this little, to start with, the main character in the game was a finger, and you just sort of moved about the place by touching the rear touch of the Vita, and they would sort of move around. So they weren't that papery, and they just kind of, nothing happened. Nothing moved. The game world was completely static. And we had this awkward thing where it didn't actually look, even though it had paper textures, it actually just kind of looked a bit like pixel art, and it was all a bit awkward. But anyway, because it didn't, even though it was trying to look papery and just failing a little bit, this put loads of pressure on the audio to like just crowbar in all this paperiness on top of everything. So the team's like, basically, our game is meant to be papery. It doesn't feel papery. Kenny, that's your fault. And in some respects, they were right, because I was making, it's not that I was making zero effort, I just wasn't adding any papery sounds in there because there was no opportunities for that. So that was really apparent to me. So I could say to them, I'm not a bad person. I'm not bad to my job. I just can't add paper in here. Like, I could, but I'm not going to. you guys need to create more opportunities for papery sounds. And I was being really selfish at that point, in the sense I was saying the game needs to be more papery, and I wasn't even thinking in it, because I'm stupid, I wasn't even thinking the game is meant to be paper, it needs to be more paper. I was just thinking, I want it to sound papery, and I can't. And so eventually, I've been saying this for weeks, and then eventually someone must have said something to me that really annoyed me. And so I made a video. If you go to the designingsound.org tearaway article I wrote, I did actually post that video on YouTube, so you can see the video I put together to explain the problem to the team, where it says,
the paper fish!
The paper fish!
Yeah!
It's a paper fish. And so you can see that video is obviously incredibly sound-centric. It's all about how if you have a piece of paper and you expect it to sound papery, which is fine, but in the game world of Tearaway, everything is made of paper, so paper in a way becomes really unspecial if everything sounds like paper. So you don't want it everywhere. Also, objects, even though everything's made from paper, clearly they're not behaving like paper. So the point of the fish example is that, yeah, it looks like a fish, and yeah, it looks papery, but it's acting like a fish. And when something behaves like two things, you kind of need a little bit of both. And so it was, but if you play both sounds at the same time, it gets muddied up, and you don't really get either, or you get one because it's dominant, and the paper just adds up ending noise to the mix, and you don't want that. So it was really trying to get the team to think about how to create opportunities for sound, so I can tell them what kinds of things would make things sound more papery and just hope that they would listen. And I think, to be honest, I don't think they listened to me anyway, and I think what really happened was they came to the same conclusion themselves about the fact that because the game didn't look and feel papery, that it was, again, it was due to the lack of papery behavior, because paper's not just a look. You can't just use paper textures and be like, oh, everything's paper, it doesn't work. It's got to actually, you know, walk the walk, and it's really got to curl up and rip and tear and do all these things that we kind of take for granted with paper. And as soon as that got into the engine, it was relatively easy. And then the conversations in my head about paperiness and papery sounds became much more sort of low level and sophisticated. They didn't have to be, but just how do we get it in there? But yeah, that was one of those challenges in pre-production where it's like you against the team. And it sounds like a negative thing, but it's not, because really what you're doing at that point is you're actually helping the project just by trying to do your job. So yeah. Paper.
Let me pull a quote from that article kind of on that topic. And this is one that Rob, you responded to in the comments. But again, talking about that role as an audio director on the project, the person who's going to the meetings and trying to inform these kind of things. You know, the quote is, "This is nonetheless an important role, even if it's utilitarian, humbling, relentless, and at times depressing. When trying to prove features, it's important that there's something resembling a complete experience. Otherwise, accurate evaluation is incredibly difficult. And audio can be the thing that makes a feature work, or conversely, and just as important, highlights aspects of which don't."
I mean, that for me is like absolutely key to my job. My colleagues are always right, like 100% of the time. When they come to me and say, "This sounds terrible," sometimes it will just be terrible. That's a sound that needs fixed. A lot of the time, there's nothing wrong with the sound. What the sound is doing is it's highlighting a problem somewhere else in the game. And so there's a sound which they're hearing an awful lot, and it's reminding them that they're failing. And as a player, that makes you feel bad. And so they're like, "This sound is terrible." And so I look at it and I go, "Well, firstly, I made that, and it upsets me, but I'm bigger than this, so I can deal with the criticism. However, I genuinely don't think that the sound is the problem here. I think that every time the sound plays, and it reminds you that you are failing and that you suck, and that we should not be doing that to our players. You've been playing this game for a year now. We should not be at a stage where you know how to use this. If this is telling you you're rubbish, then there's something wrong with the game design. So why is this sound playing so often? Oh, it's playing because someone tweaked something, and actually it used to do something else, but now it gets played more often. It's like, okay, is that intentional? Well, the change is intentional because it was trying to fix another problem, but it's created this new problem where you're constantly having to press the button, and every time you press it, you get the sound. Okay, what are we going to do about that? I mean, you have these kind of conversations that, again, like I said earlier, like you're just helping the game at that point. It starts out a conversation about sound, but it ends up that you've kind of gone, that is not how the sound was designed to be used. Why is it playing so often? It's playing so often because the game design is broken.
Yeah, and, yeah, it is. It is. I find that all the time as well in pre-pro, is that the job we're doing is to almost, yeah, shine a light on problems with game design. We're working as designers trying to fix design problems at that stage. And if sound is annoying or is repetitive or is doing something bad or it sounds bad, then it 9 times out of 10 that is because your game design is so fragile and so sort of in the early stages that you just gotta go back and rethink some of the decisions that were made before putting that sound in. I mean, a lot of designers will just sort of turn the sound down and try and sort of fight through it.
Fudge it.
But I think having the conversations.
No!
Having
those never conversations, fudge it. Never fudge it.
Just turn
but that's
it down,
how you make
it. It's all good.
Yeah, that's how you make a good experience, right? Yeah. Like, yeah, when there are these problems, not just in audio, and in every aspect of a game, if you fudge it or if you turn it down, you're not dealing with the problem. The problem is still there. So, like, yes, you've like addressed the problem a bit, but you haven't solved it.
Yeah.
And solving the problem is how you make the game experience for the person who's ultimately going to buy your game, pays your wages, better. And
sound is like the symptom rather than the sickness kind of thing.
Yeah, often. But it can work the other way too. Like, so there can be a feature which is basically, it's all but finished in terms of all the coding, the way it feels, if you're controlling a character. I've got an example that springs to mind from Little Big Planet 2, which I think was we had a grappling hook. And there was a point where it kind of did everything that it did in the finished game. And okay, it wasn't like 100% tweaked yet to feel good, but it was, all the functionality was there, but it didn't have any sound on it yet. And people were just like, I don't know, it just doesn't really seem to... And then all of a sudden we put the sound on it, it was like, this thing's amazing, what have you changed? And it's like, put some sounds on it. But it just gave people feedback. And, you know, it's these things are so hard to quantify, you know, like how do you quantify the contribution of sound? And like, so Rob, in your book, you mentioned the thing that has been done to death of, you know, sound is 50% of a film, and that, you know, games people had kind of misappropriated that, and it was all of a sudden it was sound is 50% of a game. and you know, that's just rude. idea that the audio is half the experience is just a terrible lie we told ourselves to make ourselves feel important.
I think that comes from, I think it's a George Lucas quote or something like that, where he said, sound is 50% of the movie going experience, which basically means you go to a theater, you sit there, and in the theater, that 50% of the experience that you have is sound, right? And it comes through sound. But yeah, I think it sort of got garbled and mangled along the way and became this sort of, it became 50% of the budget at one point as people were talking about it. It's like, well, you know, we should have 50% of the game's budget for audio because it's 50% of the experience. So, you know, there was all this sort of political stuff tied up in it, and it sort of developed, snowballed out of control, that phrase 50%. And, I just got to thinking about it, and I think I found myself saying it out loud once in a meeting. And I just had to stop myself and saying, "I'm sorry. That's a really offensive thing to say in a team. Is that I as an audio director, am 50% of the team." And then after that, it sort of became obvious that
even if you assume right that 50% of the experience of a game is audio, which is obviously not true. But even if you assume that, it's still not the sound designer that creates that 50%. You know, that sound gets triggered by something from the game, and that something from the game is created by a designer who wasn't able to do that by a coder. Yeah. So if you know, that 50% of the output, if you consider a screen and a speaker, the experience, in our case, it would be a third since we have an input that's in there as well. But even then, that is still divvied up between all the things that come before you.
I think what this goes back to as well is another thing that Rob spoke about in his book is the idea of getting past, just when we're all comfortable being sound designers or audio designers, getting past that and actually just trying to think of yourself as a games maker. Because, yeah, okay, you've got a speciality, and so we're audio people. Fundamentally, the way you're able to make progress within your projects and to contribute is by being able to see past your own discipline and see opportunities in other disciplines that you can feed back off and riff on. And it's something that Rob said years ago. I'm quoting you from the distant past, Rob.
Jesus.
Scary.
This is a paraphrase.
I hope you paraphrase it. I hope you're not direct quoting me from 10 years ago.
Well, I made a video from the Scarface GDC talk.
You put it on YouTube.
So we can play that one for some really
Should I do an impersonation of your accent?
Yes, please.
I'd love to hear it because I don't know what it sounds like.
I can't. I'm too Scottish.
Come on, have a go. Have a crack. Come on, you've got to. This is the last ever game audio podcast.
This is the last ever game audio podcast. Sorry. That's offensive.
Your 50% of the game audio podcast experience is Kenny Young.
I don't have an accent.
You know, you're the voice of the internet.
Oh, you all got the accent.
It's completely neutral. It's completely neutral. Sorry, the thing I was going to say was there's something you mentioned years ago that was, I guess it was your primordial vestigial thought of your, you know, be a games maker, don't be an audio designer kind of thing, where you were talking about how there's some books you were reading. There's one that's called When Somebody Dies, Everything's Purple.
Oh, yeah. If it's purple, like somebody's going
to die.
That
was it. And there was another book that you'd read about graphic design.
Yeah, how to be a graphic designer without losing your soul.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
And I bought those books.
They're awesome books, man.
I read those books.
Especially the graphic design one. That's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's all about being a freelancer as well.
Yeah,
so it's
but
the point was there's massive parallels between those subjects and audio. So it allows you to A, empathize with other people, but B, you just learn something about another craft.
Yeah.
And so it's not about trying to be a graphic designer. It's not about trying to be a set designer and know about the psychological impact of purple. But it just means that one day you've got a little bit of more of a clue about something and that you can actually understand a point someone's making in a meeting and allows you to just shimmy-shammy some good audio stuff on top of someone else's idea in a way that just wouldn't have been possible if you were pig-ignorant of other people's jobs. And I find that really inspiring, like just the idea of making an effort to learn about other people's jobs is a good thing.
Yeah,
that statement.
And a lot of that for me comes from not having anything, like hardly any books available about audio design or anything like that. Like this is 10, 12 years ago. But so you naturally kind of had to go to other disciplines to go and read about this kind of stuff because it just didn't exist in the audio world. There weren't those kind of books written. And even still today, I think I find it pretty hard to get books on audio design that are about teamwork and about collaboration rather than about technical or even artistic stuff is hard to find. Like books on mixing video games, you probably not find one of those. But something else I was trying to find any kind of literature on is mixing, which it's still can find very technical white papers and, you know, you speak to people and it's a real sort of mysterious process. And simply, I think that's because it's a collaborative process and every movie that's mixed and every game that's mixed is completely unique. It has completely unique demands of its mix and of its audio direction and as it does of its art direction and its technical solution. So, you know, I think that's the interesting part for me is that just learning that actually there isn't just one way to go and approach this and go and do it and read about it and go, okay, now I know how to do it. I'm going to go and get a job in game audio. It's, you know, listening to art directors, to producers, to designers, and being able to sort of take what they're saying and take what they're inspired by and add another layer to it and sort of sprinkle in your kind of take on it, and have a dialogue and have some kind of back and forth sort of collaboration there. And I think that's very much what you described in your, you know, Tearaway article, Kenny, was this process of just continually trying things out, continually trying to, you know, work towards a finished product. Another thing that always springs to mind is, you know, if you design a house or you want to build a house, you get an architect to sort of draw up the plans. And you probably know this, Kenny, the show Grand Designs in the UK.
I love that show.
I always watch that, and it's like
I worship the ground that Kevin MacLeod walks on.
I just find a lot of parallels in that as well. Like, you've got these guys who are, you know, it's their dream to build this house. So they, you know, invariably they have their little plan drawn up. Like, they'll get an architect to draw it, and they have a budget for it. And it's very similar to game design and these kind of...
Because it all goes wrong.
it's just like the presenter just kind of knowingly looks at the people.
Camera.
And you're going to project manage it yourself? Okay, well, yeah, that's cool, you know. Yeah.
Then they start digging. And once you start digging, the builder finds something that they hadn't quoted for in the budget.
Yeah, like a Viking burial ground or something, you know. or the steel that they ordered from Germany is the wrong size by a millimeter and the whole house won't work.
And it's never the Germans' fault. It's always someone's missed off a zero somewhere.
Yeah, and they go back to the charts and it's there it is, 48 millimeters, you know. And it's that it's seeing the wheels come off this process and seeing them actually build a house that is, it's kind of loyal to the original vision, but it's completely different in many ways. Like, maybe the bones of the house are totally different, but, you know.
It's that messy part of collaboration that I feel like is so fascinating for people. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't care what it is that's being created, you know, there is a fascination in watching that process unfold. You know, I'm a sucker for reading, you know, biographies or like, the 33 and a third series where they profile a famous record and they just talk about the process, or they talk about the like context of creating that at the time, and they just, you know.
See, did you see the movie from Searching for Sugar Man yet? It won Academy Award.
I saw that.
It's exactly what you're talking about, the process of a record, but also the history of an artist, which is why those stories for musicians are usually great, because they're such dramatic characters and everything. But actually, what you're talking about collaboration as well, I guess one reason why you don't see a book about mixing is that where it starts and ends is really difficult to say, but also it doesn't leave any kind of paper trail. You end up with maybe 20 mix files, and that you could call a mix, or maybe you call all the settings of a sound... volume, whatever, the mix, right? On a technical level, I mean. But also, even how that came about is not... There's no documentation there. You can't go in Perforce and see the history of the files and from that digest afterwards the history or the mix. Whereas for a lot of other things, like for a model or an animation, it's very easy to go back in time. And how did I develop smoke this? Alarm. Well,
smoke alarm. I need to go check out what the gas engine is drawing. Evacuate! I'll be back in a second.
Yeah, no, I think the biggest...
take a screenshot now. Oh, too late.
Okay. Yeah, that's the biggest thing on the on that mix thing is, the conversations that happen in that room, right? Those aren't documented anywhere. I guess the director has the most influence on decisions like that, because they're often sitting in that room making those decisions.
Well, and years later, you get the stories, you know, from both sides of the camp, mixing Dark Side of the Moon, and you got Alan Parsons talking about, you know, what he was doing. Then you got, you know, Roger Waters or Gilmore talking about what they were doing and what they were trying to achieve. And, you know, it all pieces together at some point, but you still don't have that context to be able to say what it was like before they put their hands on it, right?
Yeah, and a lot of it is kind of political again. It's like damage limitation. Like, an engineer's probably sat there going, well, Roger wants his guitar really loud now, so I guess I should notch it up a bit. But then when Roger goes home, they turn him down again. You know? And then the producer comes in and says, right, that's fine, that's how I want it, and off it goes. And Roger buys the record all happy. And then he puts it on. It's like they turn me down again. Then he leaves the band.
But this kind of dissection of the creative process, right? This is obviously something, you know, that people could learn from, but it's rare to have that much information put down. In fact, it's rare to have anything but the finished product when it comes to games, right? In games, it's pretty much you ship it, it's on the shelf, and everything else just gets kind of swept away in the wave of whatever's next. And that's if you're... Yeah, I think that's if your studio even stays alive past shipping that game, you know? And if your studio does close, that just gets locked in a vault forever. And
where does that stuff go?
I don't know, but...
I think it's that scene at the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark, isn't it?
Exactly, yeah. The warehouse. It does remind me, though, of this...
Top men.
There was a huge... thread about the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy text adventure game, and someone had unearthed a hard drive from Infocom or whoever it was that was creating it, and this hard drive had all of the email correspondence for the whole company on it, and it was during the time when Hitchhiker's Guide was in production or they were wrapping it up. And they pretty much published the whole thing and put it out there. And you could tie threads between all of the different people who were involved with that project. You could see the behind-the-scenes understanding of how that project came to be what it was, what involvement Douglas Adams actually had, and see the background machinations that were transpiring. And that's a rare glimpse. And I don't think that there are many places where you can get that level of detail into the production process in games. It's the warehouse at the end of Indiana Jones.
I suppose in a weird sort of way, it is similar in film, but not to the same extent, because you do have behind the scenes. But the thing about that is it's obviously completely manufactured. Mm. So you're getting... Again, to touch back on your book, Rob, you know, as I tweeted a quote from you, which I loved, which was no more pictures in front of...
mixing
cups. That was the conclusion of the conversation, was no more pictures in front of mixing desks.
Yeah.
I'll be back once... I'll continue that thread one second.
No more pictures in front of fire alarms.
Let's wait for Kenny to come back and then continue. Sake.
Right, so the conclusion of the conversation was no more standing in front of mixing desks, but the thing that initiated it was what was the point?
It was so we did a didn't we do a bit of 50%?
No, that was way before that. I was going into 30% already.
Oh yeah, no, you're right. That was a long
time. We did
a bit
of 50%, but it was
creative process?
Well, creative process, it was more... So that whole thing is about the representation of audio, both internally and externally. Whenever a film crew rock up and they're doing their, like, behind-the-scenes-y YouTube promotional video stuff, which happens, you know, the person who's directing it will be like, oh, yeah, if we can... Because they've got to make it look visually interesting, right? So they're like, okay, audio... And I don't have a mixing desk, so like I'm immune from that criticism. But like I will like carefully place my microphone next to just behind my head.
It's a very old big microphone. Audio designer.
Yeah.
Oh well, I do have a Carbon microphone collection, but that's don't get me started on that.
Yeah. There was a good one on Prototype 2. We were doing some of the making of DVD extra stuff, and it's actually hilarious because they interviewed everybody except the audio department. And they interviewed them in front of my mixing desk. So, like, everyone, like, the designers there talking about the game, mixing desk behind him.
Like, they didn't need you. They had the mixing desk.
Yeah, that's true. They're like, well, there he is over there. Yeah. But it was great.
You'd only talk about the mixing desk if they filmed you.
Yeah. They go, do you know how to use this? What does that button do?
But I think that in audio, the big sense for that kind of visual stuff is in field recording sessions. Because we go out and record sounds in so many interesting places, usually, that, you know, that's definitely the opportunity to get more interesting visual stuff.
But that's it. And that's when, so, but here's the thing, right? The premise of the video in the first place is like, it's not, what is the premise of it? Like, no one's learning anything because like, there are already several hundred video game gunshoots videos already. So when you do another one, you are confirming to the world that, yeah, okay, this is a big budget game. We've spent the money on exactly. our gun recordings and they're original and we care about our craft. And so it's all positive messages, but it's not, you know, it's not like this right now where we're furthering conversation of game audio. It's it's more about the perception of the job that we do by other people. Yeah. And so you'd love to think that the people who you work with have a much better insight into the job that you do than your average gamer. But do they?
Yeah, well,
a little bit, just because they work with you. But fundamentally, if you put out the message that, I once made a cool video where I was beating up a cooked chicken for punch sound effects. And it was cool because, that's cool. But... when you send the message out to the world that that's the job that you do, then that's what people think your job is. And that actually limits the conversations you can have with people because they think you're the person that does that, not the person who thinks deep and meaningfully about the audio experiences in the games you're
working. I've seen a lot of those videos as well. I guess it's the sort of popular media sort of vantage point on what we do, like as sound designers, is they'll have some footage of you hitting a cabbage with a hammer. And say, and I'll have some like, you know, LA TV voice come on and say, yeah, this is a day Rob spent at the office smashing a cabbage.
Yeah. What an just another day at the office.
Just another day at the office for Bridget and his team. And it's like, you know, like anyone who sees that thinks I do that every day on the job. Like into work, I've got my veggies. I come in every day, fresh veggies. Come on, guys, get the hammers ready.
Oh, not another cabbage. But also did that yesterday.
It's cabbage week. They had a sale. What?
But if you think about it, the reason those videos exist is marketing, right? They're there to sell the game in one way or the other.
It's true.
So if visually what we do most of the time is completely uninteresting to show. I mean, if we make a video of me sitting behind a desk, which is 95% of the time, with my feet up in the air playing some other game, then, you know, they're not going to have a very good impression of what I do. It's not going to sell any more games. Whereas if you show something that people might not have seen, and I know that we know that there's been 100 videos about gunshoots being done, sure. However, the people that buy games might not buy 100 games a year. They might buy... I don't know, four games a year. Maybe one of them is a shooter, so maybe they only watch the videos for the one shooter that they bought, and that one happens to have that video.
It's true, but to take the conversation, so that it's none of that's wrong, and actually, I guess I'm barking up the wrong tree, because you're right, it's all about who the videos are being made for and what their expectations are. But to go back to the conversation which Damien kicked off about, you know, the Hitchhiker's Guide game, and that was so fascinating, because it did give you a genuine... not manufactured idea of what making a game was about and how that those resources just don't exist. So I guess making of videos aren't the right way to put that across, right? Because they are about marketing. But there's got to be someone. I guess the closest I think I've seen would probably be Indie Game the Movie in terms of just getting a little bit of an insight into what it's actually like to make a game, to see the pain. on those poor game devs' faces was awesome, because there hasn't been anything like that that just gives you that fly on the wall understanding of making games.
I think making AAA game the movie would be logistically very difficult to do as a documentary maker, though.
Right, but this is the thing as well. Like, we've often talked about at Media Molecule how it would be cool, like, all right, next project we're going to put little cameras everywhere. But of course, I don't want people to see. I want people to see the good bits of me, not the bits where I'm having a hissy fit.
Nobody wants an interesting documentary that's about their lives, because you wouldn't like watching it. It would be about the stuff that is embarrassing or hard or painful, whatever.
Yeah. But that's it. That's the reason. Yeah.
And it's not going to sell you any games unless in very particular cases like the Indie Game Movie, where it actually works for the credibility of the games.
Well, there's that, but I also think it's unique in the sense that, well, several things combining. One, it's an indie film, and so we mentioned earlier that, you know, the filmmaking hasn't changed much, but, you know, there's a good example of a film which has been distributed initially, you know, on the internet and stuff. Yeah. It's word of mouth. And so obviously things have changed there a little bit. What's my point? I've forgotten my
point. Damien has a great point that's been waiting for like at least 5 minutes. And we've been blocking him. I think even though we can see it.
An interesting...
I thought that was just Damien being Damien.
Kind of. But and you usually don't get to see it, right? Unless it's live. So I'm usually better at masking it. But I've watched some really cool Twitch TV streams from Eunice Turner, a guy who works with Lambeer, working on Nuclear Throne and The Swapper. And then Robin or Not, he did some SoundSelf Twitch TV streaming. And again, here are, you know, creative sound professionals who are basically just streaming their screen while they work. And so you're getting a lot of Pro Tools, Zoom and Focus and stuff like that. And you're getting a lot of auditioning as they, you know, peruse through their sample library or whatever it is, sounds that they're designing. But as they're doing that, they're talking through that process. And I guess for me, this is a step closer than the 3-minute video of field recording. And sure. I think it's a different market. Clearly, you know, I'm not going to sit my mom down in front of that and have her soak up 2 hours of someone designing sounds
up,
and Pro
Mom!
Tools.
Yeah.
Woo! This is prime entertainment, right?
But actually, that was my point.
This is what I do, right?
Right, but just, yeah, I don't think my parents have the slightest clue what I do, really, because they just see the end result.
Yeah.
Or they do see those 3-minute videos or the stuff that I write. Mm. It always weirds me out. My mom says, I read your article. I'm like, oh, Mom, wow, weird. I don't know why. It's just because it's just weird.
Yeah,
talking to your parents about game audio.
It is.
I read your diary, Kenneth. I read your diary.
But I think, you know,
flashbacks.
It's for people like Robin currently. That's much easier to do. So they have an opportunity there to show it. I think on the bigger project scale size, for example, the Tome Benders podcast, they did some "How did I make a sound" kind of thing. So they were doing it live and explaining it as they went. Not even showing the screen, because I think for sound design, actually, that's a really good thing that they didn't have a video podcast for that. It was only about listening to the change that he did, not which buttons he pressed, which plugin he exactly used, which setting for. But it was only like, oh, I'm doing this. Why? Because I don't hear this. And so that was really good.
But that's the thing. I think the internet, which is the cause of all problems and all wonderful things in the modern age, is fundamentally you can make something and it find a market, and then word of mouth takes over and etc. So that was my point before, is that also games as a medium, as an art form, have reached a point where there is interest in how they are made by people who don't know the slightest thing about how they're made, because they do spend so much of their time gaming that they want to find out more about their hobby. So in the same way that a movie fan will watch behind the scenes, and you could say, a few years ago you could have said, people will watch these and they will never go on to make a film, even though they are gaining all this knowledge that they don't have anything to apply with. But technology is so cheap and affordable that there will be someone who will be inspired by that. And that's why it's really important, on certainly just going back to games rather than talking about film, where if we can find a way of communicating a bit more about how things are made and how good things are made as well, that is really valuable. The other thing that popped to my head was, I don't think I've seen it since, but I haven't really made much of an effort to hunt down any more examples, but when Valve, I think, was it Half-Life 2 or was it something later in the Steam engine that had the kind of... director's commentary tags.
Yeah, Portal, the first one.
It was the first Portal. Okay, so you can go through and play the game, and then when you replay it, you can turn on the mode where it's like behind-the-scenes mode, and little things are up there, and you walk through it, and it's like, oh, learn about this character here, learn about how this scene was made, and you just get people chatting. So it's little podcasts pop up, and you can hear them. And that's really cool. And that's not really kind of been taken on. I think Valve are unique, or not unique, but they were ahead of the curve in the sense that they do it's very obviously now that games are much more services, and they are live, living things, which once the game is out, it's not shipped. Okay, it's out the door, but you're still working on it for another while. Where the reason that hasn't happened traditionally is that the point that you're shipping a game, the last thing you want to be doing is making behind the scenes stuff to put into the experience. But there's no reason why you can't do that after the fact if you have the wherewithal to make that happen. And I know there'd be a massive market for that. It's just, can't be bothered. It's hard. It's extra work. No one wants extra work.
Well, I think it's also the scale of the experience. If Portal is not a 12-hour game, and doing something like that for a 12-hour campaign just seems like a huge undertaking. So, yeah.
But sure, I guess where this all comes back to is education in a lot of ways, right? On one hand, we're educating the consumer. Yeah, look at these fancy microphones, this big mixing desk, you know, these props that frame us as who we are as artists. And then taking that a step back, you look at a blog post, a video, a demonstration, a live stream, you know, where people are actively trying to communicate what it is about what they do that is, first of all, what that they're passionate about, and then second of all, as a way, I think, right? I mean, this is why we all have done what we have done with writing podcasts, blogs, etc. You know, you want to bring more people into the fold so you have new ideas, so you have new, you know, I think of you all as collaborators here. We're all collaborating on this podcast towards this idea of, you know, first of all, you know, getting our yucks up and talking about what it is that we do and love to do.
Or what? Our yucks.
Yeah, thanks. Yucks.
What's that?
It's
I'm pretty sure my yuck's not up right now.
it's just vernacular for what we do for a good time, having fun.
Yeah, I think that's what Kenny's thinking of too.
Yuck. Yuck, 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 yuck.
Is it like the opposite of when the chips are down?
The yucks are up. That's right.
it's duck hunting season.
So we're all collaborating here, talking about these things. But I think that the residual of it is, I think ideally, it's educational, right? It's to bring people into the experience with the hopes that they might, you know, first of all, learn something, take something away from it, be entertained, be inspired, right? And I think that from Anton and I certainly... And in the work that you guys have done, clearly, you know, this is something that is really important as professionals to fostering this idea of inspiration in the community.
But I think, the podcast is a great, like you've described it in the past, and it's a great way of continuing the conversations that happen when audio people get to meet up at events like GDC, right? But the other thing which I always try and encourage people to do is to write, because the nice things about reading Rob's books and articles is you can, yes, they are the result of something he's thinking about at that moment when he writes it, but the cool thing is you can go back and read what Rob was thinking 10 years ago.
That's cool for me too.
5 years ago. It's good. Well, it's good because, like, I mean, I think Rob spoke a little bit in his book. We've been talking about your book a lot, Rob. What's it called?
Game Audio Culture.
Game Audio Culture, okay, so the clue's in the name, but Rob spoke a little bit about why he writes or why he gives a presentation, in the sense that it is very much a process of formalizing and articulating where he is, particularly at the end of a project. I don't think I'm making this up, Rob. I think he wrote something like that. And but I really strongly agree with that. I find it, I've often described it as really cathartic to give a talk at the end of a project, or to write an article at the end of a project, because it's that moment where you can just, like, it forces you to survey the landscape of what you've been doing for the past year, 2 years, or 3 years, and consolidate that experience down into this little neat packaged form. So having just shipped a game, you then ship this other little project, which is your thoughts on that project.
Yeah, no.
And when you do that, it's not, it's mentally really beneficial for you to dump all that baggage.
Yeah.
But also, there's a bunch of stuff you haven't articulated yet that you've learned, but you haven't quite, you know, worked out how to describe it. And when you do that, you help yourself. But again, going back to collaborating and educating, you help other people. And so that is what we mean when we talk about the conversation.
Yes.
That's what's ongoing is, you know, it's just write about it. And I don't think there are a lot of people doing amazing work out there, and the majority of them don't write about it. And I really wish they would write more and speak more at events like GDC, because it's good for everyone.
I do it for my own personal benefit, because it keeps sanity. It totally keeps me sane. That's the only of course there's the community thing, but
bad news, it's not working.
it is working. You should have seen me before. But it's part of a massive these games are such a massive endeavor, and there's so many. Even working on a small mobile game or something like that, there's so many massive components and decisions that have to be made, and just like I go through notepads and I keep notepads of stuff and of ideas and little sketches, and I just keep digging through them, and usually there's an article idea somewhere in there, all I need to do is just write it up, and then I can store it away, very much like you suggested, Kenny. It's like I can have this archive of things I can actually go back to and look. Oh, I can look at the Scarface post-mortem that I did, and I can read that, and I'll be there again. I'll be in that space, and I'll be all that info will be fresh to me again. So it's totally a way of keeping a track of all that stuff.
But also, you know, you mentioned game audio culture, but that was really about the culture within a studio and within a team and how to make that work to audio's advantage and make the games better, et cetera, et cetera.
Spin us the pie chart, Rob. Hmm? Give us the pie chart.
No, I have to finish my point.
Okay, finish it.
Because game audio culture isn't just within the studio. Mm. It's also the culture we have within the community.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Game audio culture.
Nice.
Not game audio culture.
Yeah, nice. And it all feeds it. It all feeds from the games that we make, right? So, you know, if we work on a game, we'll have experiences making that game. Then it becomes, you write about it, talk about it, do lectures about it, whatever it is. Then it becomes a part of a wider culture and the community that we have, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And so the thing I really love is that you can go into Gamma Sutra and you can read an article from 1994 by Bobby Prince, talking about working on id games, right? And it is another world. It is a different age of game audio. But if he hadn't written that, we wouldn't have that documented. We could only imagine what it was like and what kind of things people were thinking at that point. And so we are a young industry, but to just have these historical little landmarks that you can look at, it's just amazing to go back and think how far we've come, right?
Context.
It's cool.
Yeah, context.
It's cool.
It is amazing.
Right, pie chart. Tell us about the pie chart.
Well, you were expanding it into the wider game audio. Let's suck it right down to the genesis of the
game audio
internal. The internal game audio culture. Rob, your book goes into a very, I feel like, succinct delineation between what comprises game audio culture internally, and that was epitomized by the pie chart.
Yeah,
the
all
33s.
That was—all that was a quote from Randy Tom, which was on the Designing Sound interview that he gave. And there's one sentence in his interview that just highlighted itself for me, which was that, you know, the work of a sound designer, and he's talking about in a movie, is 33% artistic, 33% technical, and then 33% social interaction. So that just that one sentence that he threw out there, sort of, I saw it sort of unfold and thought, well, this is really almost a plan for the whole audio team and how the skill sets can be balanced and how we can build like a team that has, you know, the team can either be balanced in those 33% sort of pie chart slices, or as an individual, as just one person, a one person audio team, you can look at trying to balance your daily interactions in that way as well. So rather than, you know, just sitting down hammering away at a technical task, you can, you know, in order to sort of move forward and build and grow your career or grow your experiences, you can try and have a creative aspect to your technical work or vice versa. But I think the main thing that came out of it for me was that the 33% social interaction side was almost like the minimum that you could have in order to be functional and successful in a game team. So I think the article sort of builds this idea of balancing technical and artistic along with that social thing, but the minimum social interaction that you can have with a team is 33% of your, whether that's your day or your week or however you want to cut it up, whatever works for your culture, that it was that. And that's kind of the pie chart, 33%, balancing those different skills and ideas. That can apply to a team or it can apply to an individual.
I was going to say, let's take a break with that thought. And when we come back, I want to have some more questions to you guys. But I'm going to play DB Cooper's audio vignette right now that she created for us. And she's going to talk a little bit about auditioning for a role that you don't expect to get, sort of. And I'm going, burr, 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 burr. This is me filling up time.
That's how I do it.
Hi. How many times do I need to say this? Hi, I'm DB Cooper with an audio vignette. When it comes to auditioning for roles in video games, sometimes you need to know when to not play by the rules. You need to know when to not be a good dog and go beyond the obvious. Most video game roles are for guys. That's just the way things are. There are some really dandy roles for ladies, absolutely. Lots of fabulous supporting and lead roles. But sometimes when you get an audition, there's not a lot there for you to try out for. Recently, I had an audition for a really fabulous IP that included roles for a grandma, a lady spy, an insane killer guy, a thug, a gangbanger, a wealthy businessman, and a Russian artist dude. Now, my agent lets us audition for up to 3 roles. Well, there are only 2 roles here for dames. So I did the grandma, and rather than make her a cartoon character kind of granny person, come on in and have a cup of tea, dear. Usually guys who are casting a role for an older lady are going to be looking for someone's like a kind of hip 60-year-old. So you can ask her out. Come on, you can tell me about it. And I did the lady spy. Don't make me come in there. Unless that's what you really want. So then what else do I have? I want to show the audio director and the casting people what my range is. So what other choice do I reasonably have? An insane killer guy? The role is written for a man. They're not going to hire a girl for it, and it didn't seem reasonable to try that one. I want to try something else, but I don't want to waste anybody's time. Thug? No. Gangbanger? Wasn't something I really felt I could pull off. Wealthy businessman. The way this role was worded did not lend itself to being that high-powered lady in a suit. But this Russian artist guy, that was worth taking a swing at. Why should I be afraid to tell you my process? You can never come anywhere close to me. You will never be as great as me. So I sent these off to my agent. And in the end, guess what I got cast for? Not the Russian artist guy, but a Russian bad girl who wasn't even part of the audition.
If your friends could see you now, they would know you for the coward that you are.
So don't get hung up on playing by the rules. With an audition, you've got nothing to lose and everything to gain. I'm DB Cooper.
It would be what DB does not explain is how to do that without annoying people. Because that's the art. The art isn't in seeing an opportunity, it's in pulling it off. And I can imagine if I was in an audition and someone's like, hey, no, I can do this, I'd be like, next. So it's sweet-talking people in a way or being charming enough that you could then create that in, that they will even tolerate you suggesting for a role that you're not. That's a skill. I want to hear that GDC talk.
Well, I think you need a special hat.
Jedi mind tricks.
So, in a lot of ways, that's back to the social, right, of that 33% pie chart. It's like, how do you become good at being social, playing the Jedi mind trick, or having a programmer do something for you that they might not really want to do? You know, how do you...
That's all programming tasks.
Okay. I'm glad you said it, but, you know...
So
there's a lot of social skills that I feel like are not... First of all, there's probably not a whole lot of social classes in college or even high school where they're like, hey, you know, to get things done, sometimes you need to be easy or you need to find the motivation or, you know, whatever it is. And then, you know, again, how do people cultivate that social side of things?
Do you want us to answer that individually?
I mean...
You looking for top tips? I mean, for me, I think being honest is absolutely crucial because if anyone was... You've got to be a real genius to be able to be a proper puppet master and tell people one thing when you're thinking another. You know what I mean? Like, if you're going to say to someone, hey, you know, I can't even think of an example because that's just not how my brain works. I just tell people what I'm thinking.
Yeah.
Like, I don't bullshit people. I don't give them what I think they want to hear. I don't see the point in that. Like, I mean, just what? I mean, I would rather upset someone a little bit by telling them the reasons why I'm asking them to do something than I would be, like, their best friend. I think fundamentally, I mean, that's you can still communicate things in an honest way without being a dick. Like, those are two separate things. You shouldn't get them confused. Although I'm frequently a dick, but I don't want to be. I just am. Mm-hmm. But I think being honest is just the way forward. It's just good. It lets people know what you're thinking.
Yeah,
I'd
agree with that. I also think that there's a fine line between being a collaborator and being a friend and understanding people's motivations outside of the task at hand, right? And that's, I guess maybe they call that a relationship, right? You have a relationship with someone. You understand what they're invested in. And you can try and help them understand your investment through the experience that you have working with them, right? Which is a, you know, weird way of saying, you know, motivating people. But again, it's that relationship that you build with someone that is inherently social that is going to help you when you hit the wall and you need a feature and you're like, well, you know, remember how easy it was that last time we did it? Yeah, okay, this is going to be just as easy.
Yeah, I love that, actually, Damien. That's exactly the way I think about it. And one of the things that really, really annoys me currently about the games industry and, you know, particularly long, long projects, like three-year, two-year projects, is that you will learn all these, you'll get to know all these people and collaborate with them, learn how to do it, and get to know almost what the next person's going to think before you ask them the question. So you build these really, really great trusting relationships on a project, and then you'll get to the end of that project, and you know, five people leave the team, and you know, three new people come on, a new art director joins or whatever, and you've actually got to start rebuilding that process again. And it's really frustrating because, you know, you feel, I still miss the team, the Scarface team that I first worked with, because purely because we were just, by the end, we've been through so many kind of hard problems and dealt with so much, and the project nearly getting canned and all this sort of stuff. And we, you know, we made it through, and it was just such a bonding experience that it's actually quite hard to sort of see that team, you know, fall apart and morph into something else, into a different team. But then, you know, after another project with the new team, it's like, yeah, this is awesome. And then the same thing happens again, kind of thing.
Yeah.
But that's the thing, I think, in the same way that a relationship, I mean, the word implies history and it implies that, you know, you've got that experience behind you together. But the weird thing is that projects forward.
Yep.
So I've been working with the same audio coder for the last 10 years. So even though before I joined Media Molecule, coming up for 7 years ago now. Oh my God, how did that happen? I was working at Sony, and Matt Willis, he was audio coder on Little Big Planet 1 and 2 and on Tearaway, he came and joined us for Little Big Planet 1. And so we've got this kind of weird non-verbal thing. Telepathy goes on, but I don't mean that seriously. I mean more the fact that we've been through an awful lot together. And so when things are difficult, the thing that I think fundamentally makes our relationship work is that Matt knows no matter how awkward I'm making his life at that moment, it is because I'm trying to make the project better. And so that kind of carrot on the stick, that faith, if you like, that he's like, I don't know what you're talking about, but okay. I can almost see that face where he's just like, he kind of, he lets me know he doesn't want to do it, but I know as I walk away from his desk that he's gonna look into it.
Because games are so difficult to make, and because so many things are unknown, especially at the start of a project, for myself, just looking back at doing a launch title, so many unknowns a couple of years ago, so many guesses you had to take, and chances, you wouldn't want to do those kind of things so readily and easily if you weren't with people that you trust. And that trust is always earned and never, well, it's given, and then later either you earn it or you don't, that you have it, right? And the relationships that you have for longer mean that they work well, otherwise there's something wrong in the company. And so if you've, and the longer it lasts, the better the trust is and the easier things are. So, you know, exactly like this, or the risky things that you want to do at the start of a project that you know you will have a lot of headaches 2 years from the down the line if it's wrong. If you're making really big risks, then you know you can only do those things with a team that trusts each other. So if you don't have that, you really means that it's going to affect your project and your life, because it will mean your happiness in the project, or if it doesn't work out, your unhappiness in your own life, because you'll be doing many more hours to complete the project.
Yeah, and there are definitely shortcuts that you can take with that sort of stuff with new teams. Like they can, you know, they can really work hard on like a super early vertical slice or something like that, or where you sort of have a mini project that, you know, everybody gets to work together and sort of see how this engine sort of fires up together.
Sure.
Another interesting thing about like mobile development is that you'll ship 3 games a year.
Oh yeah.
Or something like that. So you've got a team that's very small. It can do games really quickly. Games are really more like milestones, I guess, for AAA milestones. So, you know, the sort of those relationships are, I think, what really fundamentally makes good games, I think, is, you know, if everyone's comfortable with each other, can take risks, like you said, Anton, and, you know, be honest and, okay, I've got some crazy idea, but Anton says, nah, we'll never, honestly, I've tried this, we're not gonna pull it off. And I'll trust Anton, right? I'll be like, yeah, okay.
So, you'll hit him a little bit as well, you'll trust him.
I don't know. Yeah, so it's that aspect. But I guess the upshot of that is, you know, to say the art director leaves, like he takes that relationship that, you know, he's had with that team with him to a new team.
Yeah.
And it's sort of gradually, I think, as the game industry goes on, I think the more experienced people you get in there, those, like, that trust almost sort of doesn't come for free and automatic, but at least it's sort of built in. Like, I know I can go straight to the art director and start working with him, and, you know, I don't have to sort of figure out how to do that anymore. Like, and similarly, the art director knows that, you know, there should be a relationship with the audio director. So maybe on his first day in the new job, or the producer's first day in the new job, they go and find out who those people are, introduce themselves, go out for coffee, do all that stuff, get it out of the way. So I think that is something that's positive that comes out of people moving into new projects and new cultures as well. If you work in many different companies and different cultures, I think you start to take the best of those cultures and try and apply it to every new place that you arrive at, which I think is super beneficial for everybody, really. Like anything that's bad and didn't work, you just never want to see those processes again. So
yeah.
You know, if you find something similar at a new company, you'll make it your job to try and get rid of it or break it down. And as an outsider, sometimes you can have much more power doing that, I think.
Yeah, no, I think Damien is the prime example of that, because I don't think anybody in game audio has done so many crunches in AAA titles as Damien has over the last 2 or 3 years. So, like, the thing about being in crunch is, and of course, how many hours that entails is different for every company, depending on how well the project is managed. But what's the same for every project will be the amount of pressure felt by the team. The stress will be equally big, whether or not you make 100 hours a week or normal 40 hours. There's still a game that has to be done at a certain date. And that brings out the worst in everybody. You know, it's definitely not the prettiest time to know people, but if you can go through those periods and survive and actually be like, and you know each other better through it, you know, that's super wonderful, I think.
Yeah, and I think at the end of every project, we would all probably agree that during those times, the thing that keeps us sane are the people. Right? Making the game will make you crazy fast. Okay. But the people you work with will talk you back from the ledge. They will help you push through that brick wall you're banging your head against. And they will find a way to equalize the intensity of that period of development.
Not everybody, though. Yeah. Let me quickly drop in there, because there will definitely be, the bigger the team, the more of them there will be there. People, it's not a really good translation for it from Dutch, but I call them stress bringers. So
crazy makers.
Well, yeah, that translates quite well.
There are definitely the people that you should try to eliminate from, if you can, if it's not the game director, hopefully, you know, then you should try to isolate them from your life, because there will always be that some guy on a project that will, if he gets in the way of your thing, you know, you won't be sleeping at night because of that shit. Yeah. And but
again, I think there will always be that aspect, but it will be the other people on the team.
Yeah. Okay. Help you through. I was just saying that there, it's not just the positive, not the people. If the people were all positive, you know.
That's not to say that all people are a benefit to your sanity. Yeah. Just that at the end of it, you will see the good ones as having contributed to your ability to do this superhuman task of shipping a game, which sometimes is a painful process, right?
Yeah. And you do, Anton, you do, totally run across these archetypes, right? The more places you go to, you run across the archetypal, you know, guy who won't stop talking to you in the corridor, or the guy, you know, all these different kind of archetypes. And you sort of start to, it's not really fair to do this, but you start to have a little way of dealing with each of those personality types. You know, it's not fair, because this guy is nothing like that other guy who drove you crazy. You know, but at least you have some mechanisms to sort of stay sane and try and deal with it. And it starts to boil down a lot. It's really weird.
Yeah, it is interesting. There's probably like 7 types of people in the world.
But it's the same if you worked in a warehouse, like, they'd be the same.
But there's certain archetypes. But the thing about crunch in particular is, like I said, it brings out the worst in people. You know, it can literally drive people nuts. So you will see all those worst aspects come out on a daily basis. And if you can then, you know, find a way and still be creative and collaborative, then you've got a rock solid team going. That was really the...
Yeah.
True.
Yeah. Ken, how much did you crunch on Tearaway?
You know what? I crunched so much, I don't even know how much I crunched, which is weird, because like on Little Big Planet 1, there was a definite period of like, I mean, I was at the extreme end of things, probably even more so than most people, because I was just so up against it, because I was like doing this whole game audio experience by myself, which is a bit crazy. That was like 6 months of, but it was weird. LBP1 was weird because I loved it. Just because we were on a mission and we had all this media attention and it was like all hyped up. It was like, oh my God. So it was, I mean, I'm not saying it was easy, but it was weird. We were definitely kind of riding a wave of something and that was cool. LBP2, there was a little bit of crunch on that. It wasn't as bad. It was a much harder project than the first game just because it was a sequel and, you know, you've got to build on stuff. Tearaway was painful all the way through. Wow. Over several, not in terms of crunch, just emotionally. Yeah. And it was just hard. It was the hardest project I've ever worked on for various reasons, which I won't go into. But we shipped an awesome game, so it's all good at the end of the day. And like you're saying, we did get there, and it was because of the team and those relationships that we managed to ship something that we're really proud of. But to be honest, I think my life has been a bit of a mess for the past 18 months, mainly because of work, just being so focused on it. And I didn't crunch in like the insanely long hours and weekends thing. I think there was maybe that for about a month right at the end. But generally, I've just been doing a bit longer hours for the past kind of year and a half, just trying to tread water. So I wouldn't call it crunch. I would. It's something else.
I did the exact same thing actually on Shadowfall, where I would come in. I would actually come in an hour earlier instead of staying much later.
Yeah.
That kind of deal.
The quiet mornings.
But it still takes its toll because I've been on holiday. The last holiday I had was the Christmas before. I didn't have any holiday last year, and I just took 2 months off. So I've been off since the beginning of November, and I just moved house. So I've been like, I've moved from shipping Tearaway to like selling a house, and like now I'm like tiling my bathroom. I sent a picture to Damien earlier.
Looking good.
I'm like OCDing. It's little mini metro tiles. It's awesome. But I genuinely think that's relevant to what we're talking about because we're talking about.
You gotta ship that tile sometime, man.
I'm serious. When I finished Tearaway, if I didn't move from one big project onto another like project, I think I would have got seriously depressed because to be working so intensely for, you know, over a year, maybe 2 years, and then all of a sudden just like stop. That would be like a knife.
It's called post-traumatic stress disorder. It's called.
Yeah, it would have been weird. So to be able to basically, I moved house 2 weeks before we shipped Tearaway, which is not recommended at all. But you know, one of the most stressful things you can do in your life, on top of one of the most stressful things you can do in your life, wasn't cool. But anyway, but be able to move onto like my DIY tasks and like take it at my own pace.
Yeah.
I think that was really healthy.
Definitely.
And that was like my way of dealing with post-projectic stress.
Yeah.
PTSD.
It's a real thing. It's a real thing. It is a real thing.
For sure. Like you spoke about earlier how writing about stuff at the end of a project keeps you sane. I think that's another example of that where you're trying to come down slowly from the intensity of the really busy period of making the game.
I remember at the end of Killzone 2 that was quite an intense crunch. That was that was as far as hours and you know, that was the worst one for me for sure. At one point suddenly somebody the technical director locked the entire Perforce database, literally control L on the on the folder, and we were done. And it was just such a
that happened to me. That was a formative experience for me on the first game that I worked on, and it wasn't because I guess it was maybe just bad communication, but I was like working away and I was like working away, and I knew that there was a deadline coming up the end of the week or something, and then at some point the game director comes up and is like, right, that's it, we're done. I'm like, what? I'm not done. I'm like, I need to fix, there's no smoke sound on that smoke in the last level. And he was like, I don't care, we're done. And I was like traumatized. I was like, ugh. I felt like someone had pulled the rug out from under my feet. And I think that's an important lesson, is that when it's done, it's done. And it ships. And you do, if you want, you, it's your work. You've been working on it for a long time. You want the world to experience it and be proud of it. So in a way, that is ensured that I've always tried to make sure that everything is done to the best of my abilities.
When it's done.
When we ship a game. Yeah, exactly.
Which makes a perfect close up for the podcast.
Yeah.
This is
but
it.
It's done. It's done. This is it.
Let's
man, the last
ship
ever.
This
the
one.
Last ever game audio.
So, no, thanks a bunch for being on the podcast.
Yeah. But
great conversations.
Yeah. Thanks for being on the podcast. I just want to bring up a couple things actually related to this. Yeah.
What?
I want to
close this shit out.
No, 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 no. This is like downloadable content for this podcast.
Yeah,
that is completely downloadable.
Day one patch.
You're breaking my shit, man.
No, I'm not breaking your shit. I promised some people over at Guerrilla Cambridge I would bring this up, so I'm going to. And I wanted to tie it in nicely when Rob said something, but I couldn't. Because whatever. So, Guerrilla is looking for two audio-related people right now. Vacancies. Oh, nice jobs. People want to hear about this. Guerrilla is looking for an audio coder over in Cambridge. Yes. It's my podcast too. I get to, put this flag up there. And
yeah,
the
well, this means we got to ship it before, fucking next
yes,
year, I guess.
Exactly. I'm putting a deadline on it. And the other one is we're looking for a lead over in Guerrilla Amsterdam. So if you want to apply for that, just go to the Guerrilla Games site and you can apply right up there.
Listen, I really like Anton, so if anyone out there wants to work with him, I think it would be a good choice.
Well, all right. No, thanks, Damien.
Can we end this now?
I have one thing to say. I'd like to apologize for shouting. I've not been listening to my voice on a monitor, so I've been like I have got headphones on, so I'm doing that like trying to make myself loud thing, and I'm Scottish and shouty as it stands, so I reckon I've been shouting the whole
what?
Through.
We'll put a limiter
like
on
to,
it.
I'd like to apologize to the listeners for shouting. That is all.